This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. There were fires on Wednesday at the Oseti Sakowin camp at Standing Rock, North Dakota. They were not lit by law enforcement, but by water protectors themselves by the time a deadline for the camp to be cleared arrived. Authorities had cited safety reasons for the eviction of water protectors. Still, more than 70 people defied orders by remaining at the camp and were arrested. The clearing of the camp represents the end of a chapter in what is arguably the highest profile and longest standing environmental action in U.S. history. Water protectors, who are determined to stop the multi-billion dollar Dakota Access Pipeline, vow they will begin a new chapter and that the fight is not over. My guest is Joy Braun. She's a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. Welcome to the program, Joy.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, can you tell us a little bit about why the authorities actually required that the camp be evicted? They cited spring flooding and safety issues as a reason. The Army Corps of Engineers set the deadline of Wednesday, February 22nd. But is that the main reason why that happened?
That's what they said. However, the flood prediction from the Army Corps of Engineers themselves was downgraded so that there was no flood warning or no flood imminent at all. And so they were using falsified data to try to get us out of there.
So the actual camp itself, Oseti Sakowin, I mentioned there were fires that were lit. And it was a dramatic, visually dramatic event. A lot of people worried that the fires had been set by police, by Army Corps of Engineers. But I understand that it was actually the water protectors that set fires as part of a leaving ceremony. Can you explain for our audience why it was important to leave in that way?
Well, it's important to remember that we had a camp, treaty camp, back on October 27th that was raided by the police. Horribly, forcibly removed from that camp. And a lot of our teepees and our belongings, when we got those back, they had been ripped. Fecal matter was on them. They had been destroyed and returned to us in horrible, inhumane condition. And so it was decided at the camp itself that we would go ahead and set fire to some of the buildings and some of the infrastructure so that we didn't have to go through that trauma again. We've been through a lot over the past several months, and we decided to take ownership of that destruction and just do it ourselves.
How long had you been there? Can you tell us a little bit about your role in the movement?
I have been camping. I was the very first camper at Sacred Stone Camp on April 1st of last year. And I've been boots on the ground since February, helping the grassroots, the local people here organize not only this camp, but also their resistance to Dakota Access Pipeline and to their resistance to fracking further upfield at three affiliated tribes. So I've been here for a very long time. Just working with the local people, working with different tribes. I've worked all along the entire route of Dakota Access from North Dakota all the way to Illinois, working with different tribal organizations, different grassroots organizations, and in building allies, in building friendships and bonds so we could fight this pipeline.
So where were you when the fires were lit? Were you also among the last to leave the Oseti Sakowin camp?
I had already left the camp, and there was a Bureau of Indian Affairs police barricade that had been set up. So I went up to one of the bluffs that I could oversee everything, and I was texting people, I was calling people, I was trying to get messages in there. Unfortunately, there was a lot of scramblers that were going on, but we couldn't get a lot of information in or out. So I was watching through binoculars and a telescope and running to Sacred Stone and Black Hoop and Eagle's Nest Camp and trying to get information and trying to get people out safely.
And as people began to leave, there was sort of a ceremonial leaving. We'll play a video for our TV audience of that departure. A lot of the elders, I understand, led folks with music and departed the camp. Here is a little bit of what that scene looked like. And that is a glimpse of what the Osseti Sakhawin camp looked like on February 22nd, the day that water protectors had been given a deadline by the Army Corps of Engineers to leave the camp. Now, I understand that Camp Sacred Stone, which was the first camp that was set up, which is on private property, and sounds like that's where you started your camp out, that is still standing?
Yeah, Sacred Stone Camp is still standing. And there's several other camps that have popped up because we needed to move. But yeah, Sacred Stone is still there.
And so going back to Osseti Sakhawin, 76 people were arrested. These were people who chose to remain there, risked arrest, and were arrested. And over the course of this past year, many people have been arrested. As far as you know, what has happened to those who were arrested? Have they been released yet? Are they being charged with felonies like some people had been?
So they were transported to four different jails in North Dakota, and some of them have been released. Some of them are still awaiting release. They're being charged with trespassing and other resisting arrest and a few other charges like that. So we're waiting to see what everybody is being charged with, and to get them back to the camp and back to safety.
And the conditions were quite severe and still are. I mean, it's very cold. It's already a very windy place to begin with. When winter set in, there was a lot of snow and ice. How hard has it been for people to remain up until that deadline near the location of the pipeline and even continuing to remain at the other camps right now, given the weather conditions?
We have been through minus 47 degrees.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
With wind chill, with wind gusting up to 85, 90 miles per hour at different times. We've made jokes about it, saying you might be a water protector if a Sunday stroll is going in minus 47 degrees. You might be a water protector if it takes longer to dress and undress to go to the bathroom.
Wow.
We've been through a lot, but it's cemented our friendships, our bondships together, and it also shows our commitment that this is not just a Native American issue, this is a human issue, and we've been standing together with our allies to protect the 18 million people downstream from this particular pipeline, and you know, we're here to protect water. We're here to protect life. And our cry, Miniwitoni, means water is life. And that's the cry that we've asked people to carry forward in their own water fight.
Well, the personal sacrifice that so many water protectors have undertaken has been really humbling, particularly for those of us watching from afar. So the big question now is, what's next? Donald Trump has decided this pipeline will go ahead. He personally has financial stakes in this pipeline. Not that those ethical conflicts of interest have so far stopped him in any realm. But it seems as though the struggle under a President Trump is even harder than it was under President Obama.
It's going to be harder under President Trump. But at the same time, we have to remember that a presidential memorandum doesn't supersede the United States Constitution. And the U.S. Constitution says that treaty is the supreme law of the land. The whole reason why we were at Osseti Sakhawin camp, the resistance camp, was that we were standing on treaty, and that we did not have free prior informed consent, as is required by the United Nations and all the nations that agreed to that. that the Indigenous people need free prior informed consent for projects go through their traditional lands and territories. And we did not give that free prior informed consent for that. That this project is detrimental, and there's other projects that are detrimental. It's definitely going to be an uphill battle. However, because the memorandum does not supersede the United States Constitution, we also are set to, you know, further go through legal battles, do whatever is necessary to make sure that the people here are protected, not only for Standing Rock, but also the other Sioux Nations downstream, be that Rosebud, Crow Creek, Lower Brule, Cheyenne River, and Pine Ridge. So we need to stand together and keep standing united, because we're going up against a huge uphill battle, not only against infrastructure projects such as this particular pipeline, but also healthcare and also education and everything that would affect every other American here in Native Nations feel it even worse, because we have economic base that other people have. And, you know, here on Standing Rock, we talk about 92% unemployment. On my reservation, we talk about 90% unemployment rate. And to put that into perspective, an economic depression is considered when you have 30% unemployment. So double that, that's what you have with the different reservations.
The issue of getting the word out about what's happening, not just at Standing Rock, but more broadly speaking, in Native communities, has really depended on good journalism. And one of the things that we've noticed over these past few months is how incredible Indigenous journalism has been. Journalists with the Indian Country Today Media Network and many other outlets that have really covered this issue quite well from a Native perspective. How important is it for us to get information from sources that really reflect the lived experiences of those communities?
It's extremely important. You see a huge difference in reporting from the Indigenous perspective versus the non-Indigenous perspective. For example, KFYR out of Bismarck, which is a television station, came out to Ochetti Chateau and was saying, oh, there's feces. We've had reports of feces on the ground. There was never any feces on the ground. What they were afraid of was they were afraid of our compost toilets. Mm. That's what they were afraid of. They were afraid. They were scared to use our compost toilets. And so they made up a thing about feces on the ground. But we're saving water, we're composting. Hey, you know, this is what we're doing to take care of this particular issue, and it's healthier, it's cleaner, and it's better for the environment. It can really be different. The other difference is that a lot of our Native journalists did go to jail. A lot of our non-Native journalists went to jail, and the non-Indigenous mainstream media did not go to jail. So there was definitely racism involved in that.
And actually, can you tell us a little bit about how journalists were treated during the clearing of the camp on February 22nd when the Army Corps of Engineers moved in, when police moved in? Were journalists denied access to protesters, to water protectors, and as well as to simply film what was happening?
So on the 22nd, the reporters, they had to get credentialed to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they were penned up in a very small area and not allowed to leave that area. Those reporters or journalists that chose to leave the area that was designated for them, risked arrest. Now, on the 22nd, the police did move into the camp, but they pulled back. And that's why you have such a high number of arrests. The next day, because there was more people had managed to cross the river and stayed at the camp the next day. And that's when you saw the highly militarized police. And they didn't just bring non-lethal weapons yesterday. Yesterday, they brought armed weapons, and they were pointing AK-47s and other assault rifles at elderly and at women. They really did a number on us yesterday.
I want to play for you and our audience a video of one journalist who was at the camp when it was cleared, where she described how basically she had been chased out of there.
I just got chased by law enforcement. There's a huge standoff happening right now, and they're not even coming after water protectors. They're coming after journalists. I'm Facebook live feeding. Find me on Facebook, Jenny Monet. They put some kind of sanction on outside media and only allowed North Dakota media to stay put. And then when I questioned why a New York City-based ABC News national photographer was in the mix, they started chasing after me. I'm feeding live. There's a huge standoff on my Facebook live at Jenny Monet.
And that is a journalist who explained how she was basically chased out of there and they're arresting journalists. And we don't hear hardly anything about that in a lot of the coverage. Well, Joy, I understand there's going to be a national march. There are national marches happening around the country and a main march in Washington, D.C. on March 10th as another stand against the Dakota Access Pipeline. What do you know of that? Is that one way in which people can also express solidarity?
Yeah, absolutely. They can go to any one of their regional marches, or they can do a march themselves. But on March 10th, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chairman, Dave Archambault, asked for all the Native Nations who came and supported the efforts here at Standing Rock to please show up in Washington, D.C. and march to the White House to emphasize that we're still standing for water, that we're still fighting Dakota Access Pipeline, but also the greater issues and the nations are going to face under a Trump administration, such as he wants to privatize reservation lands, basically wants to get rid of Native reservations. He wants to get rid of our status as Native people. He wants to make us non-Native, and that's not going to happen. He's trying to genocide us by paperwork. And so this is a really scary time for us as Native people. But I know that if we stand in solidarity, I know that if we stand in prayer, I know that as long as we stand united, we can defeat this racism that's spreading across the United States.
Thank you so much, Joy, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest is Joy Braun. She's a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/RU with Sonali.